everybody, and welcome back into the Sorry to Interrupt podcast. Frenchie, we are back for our final installment of the French Fry before you grace all of us with your Giants, Jets, Cowboys, mocks, and the first round. But we got to still get a couple positions down here, man. We got linebackers, we got corners, we got safeties. And as you said the other night, I could not let you leave without special teams. So linebackers are where we start off. But first of all, buddy, how we doing?
We're doing all right. A little drained, a little excited. The Rangers just came off a big win, and Tom's not here, so I can mention perfect.
Congratulations, by the way, on the Knicks and the Rangers. MSG is having a weekend, bud.
I mean, we are living our best. Listen, the second we had an eclipse and an earthquake in the same weekend, I was like, there's some shit in the air. This could be it. But, you know, that's what we say before we get swept.
Also, UConn basketball won the Big East tournament a month ago, so that's cool, too.
That doesn't really affect anything. They win shit all the time.
Goddamn right they do. All right, let's start with the linebackers, man. This is an interesting group because I don't know how loaded it is. I haven't seen anybody really mocked in the first, but I know you have done your research, so let us go, man. Where are you seeing this linebacking group so far in 2024?
You're still not going to see it mocked in the first. Sorry if that ruins it for all of the big linebacker fans out there who aren't going to tune in after tomorrow's recording, but this is a relatively sparse group, depending on how you look at them, but we have a couple guys who I think have some real roles that they'll be able to fill, if nothing else, at least. But my top guy, I think I've got a mid-second round grade on him, and I could see someone taking a shot at the size and the athletic ability of him, and that's Edgerrin Cooper out of Texas A&M. 6'2", 230, wide, 34-inch arms. He uses that radius, not just with tackling, because you can't get those arms out too wide. That's how separate shoulders. Keep that in mind for all the kids out there. But he uses that a lot in coverage, where he does a really great job there. He's usually, not usually, but consistently in motion. He's the type of hair on fire player that you want at your linebacker position. He does a really good job of blitzing, especially reading the offensive line if he's sitting there in zone and might crash down, or if he's just doing a QB spy. He's a good blitzer, very good zone defender, and he hits heavy. And one of the things I like most is when he comes downhill, he's got really quick transitions. But the reason he's here instead of in the first round with all those nice things I just said is because he's got a problem with his tackling. He goes too high. And for someone at 6'2", he doesn't have that, you know, N'Kobe Dean stout build that's just going to make it so you can't tackle high. That's still a technique thing he's got to work on. And he's been a linebacker for quite a while now. So you got to hope that you can still keep coaching that out. And also, he struggles in play action. Play action can get him to take an extra step, can get him to freeze and throw off that little hitch that he might have at the start as he, you know, goes down. A lot of times when he's flat, he can be a little slow from the flat-footed positions. He's a lot better when he's lined up and has one foot in front of the other. It allows for a little bit of a quicker motion from him off the snap, but it does also give the quarterback and the offensive line a bit of read of where he's going. Some of the stuff that he does really well are, you know, combo coverages and fake coverages. So when he's lining up as if he's a blitzer and then he bails, that's something where you really get to see his athleticism shine. So the sort of defense like what Vic Fangio would always be running and the Fangio system that's really taken over the NFL, a lot of cover four shell and cover three blitz. That's the sort of thing where I think Cooper could be a really good player for somebody.
Critiques that you have coachable, or are those things that are going to probably be something that hampers him in his development and inevitably when he starts getting more playing time?
Well, I think the high tackling is a coachable thing, but we see some players who do get caught in technique, and I don't think it's uncoachable, but it is something to just keep an eye on. The play action piece, I mean, that's just, you got to drill some reads into him or put him in a position where he's not going to be, you know, the mic, where he's going to have a little bit more leeway. But that's something where I think you can, that I think is a little bit more coachable. That allows him to just focus on a couple keys, and you can work through that sort of thing, as opposed to something like high tackling. And when you've done something, particularly you've used a technique for so long, that's a little bit trickier to kind of unlearn those pieces. But that's not to say it can't be done, and we might look back at this in a year or two when he's corrected some of those pieces and all of a sudden he's one of the best players and we're all slapping ourselves, why didn't we take him in the first round? So it's not that it's uncoachable, but these are a couple areas in which he needs to improve in order for him to take that next step when he's in the league. But it's also the areas in which he's a little deficient right now that keep him from being a first round prospect.
Before we get into the rest of your grouping, the linebacker position as a whole, where do you value that right now in today's NFL? Do you look at certain players and say they could be hybrids? We want to put them at safety. Does that make them more valuable? You see somebody like a Micah Parsons where you kind of line him up as a defensive end at a lot of times and let him rush the passer. Like, where do you look at the linebacker position? I know we kind of lumped them as a whole between outside and inside and middle linebacker for this French five, but where do you look at the position as a whole in the value end of today's NFL?
So for me, when I'm doing these positional rankings, what I'm looking at is the majority of your snaps coming off the line of scrimmage? So you might be called a linebacker, but if you're in a two-point stance, but you're on the line, I have you in my edge group. For these players, I'm talking mostly about guys who, you know, majority of their snaps are 5 yards off the line of scrimmage, 5-7 yards. And, you know, they're lining up, reading the blocks and going downhill that way. Where it is in the league right now, I think that most linebackers, the idea of having a linebacker safety hybrid, those are mostly bigger safeties. Someone like James Williams from Miami, who's a 6'5 safety, but sometimes plays like a 6'5 safety. He's no Kyle Hamilton. He's got some issues with quickness and things like that. So he transfers more down to the money backer role. The more that the game gets predicated on speed, the more it is that we take bigger safeties and move them to the box, as opposed to taking the smaller linebackers and move them out. Like, you know, happened years ago with, I think John Lynch had that transition coming out of college. And we see that with the Micah Parsons and other folks. You want linebackers who can hold their spot in zone, but even linebackers that cover tight ends in man are relatively rare now, or your own. Going with a really heavy blitz, so they're covering for less than 2 seconds, or you're accepting that if that blitz doesn't work, well, that's going to be a completion. So for me, it's the linebacker position has been more of a downhill position than it's been in a while, because the focus for linebackers, the extra thing that teams are looking for more than can they play the slot if they're a smaller one. You know, I had this issue when I was mocking and rating Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, and it took so long for the NFL to catch up to his sort of player where he can be that type of hybrid. And as we've seen the hybrid safety linebacker come out, the ones that have been a bit more successful are the ones who come from that safety position downwards, where your quickness is an advantage, but your physicality lines up, as opposed to someone who's a bit stronger, a bit more physical, but can also cover. Can also cover is not enough with slot receivers and, you know, the tight end slash slot positions that are mostly these, you know, big name tight ends right now. So for me, where the linebacker position is trending is more towards guys who are off ball on, you know, run pass downs or more run situations, but in passing situations, more likely than not, you're either dropping into a zone if you're a linebacker or you're blitzing. And that's in some part because Wink's no longer in the NFL. So that's a bit of how I'm seeing the change in the linebacker position. But it also involves a lot more off-ball linebackers, you know, going down and setting an edge down again and crashing hard to set that and send it back into the other linebackers, especially as we move more towards 3-3-5s. And, you know, the nickel is now the most used position. Most teams play with five combined safeties and corners. That's what you have on the field most of the time, because most of the time the other side's got three wide receivers and you got to transition and make it work. So guys like Cooper, who can survive and hold their own in coverage, are a major asset for a lot of teams, especially those who are willing to play more zone. But especially as you move more towards the money downs, where you see more blitzing and those sorts of things, instead of having linebackers in coverage, a lot of teams will switch to having, put in a fourth corner or a third safety and just have a single linebacker on the field and, you know, stack the rest with rushers.
What's fascinating about all of that, and by the way, that's just why you're the best, man. I mean, that breakdown is absolutely phenomenal. I'm thinking about somebody like an Isaiah Simmons, right, who's a top 10 pick and has a lot of versatility, but Arizona didn't really know how to use him. And over a different chain of coaching changes, they kind of just rendered him useless and sent him to the Giants for a seventh-round pick. The Giants were, you know, beneficiaries of having him for a year and also then re-signing him. And I think about him as kind of that modern-day linebacker where, yeah, you could put him at the linebacker, but he's also kind of a safety. He's a ball hawk, but he's also, you know, get him in the middle of the field and let him tackle. He's kind of positionless. We talk about the NBA now transitioning into a positionless era. And the NFL on defense in particular, and I think the offense is coming into that as well, there's a lot of these guys that are just super hybrid athletes that we don't really have a pure position for you. And certain coaching staffs and certain front offices don't really know what to do with them. And I look at Cooper as one of those guys who you should have a place for him, but you should also have a lot of ability to let him kind of do what he does best.
Yeah. And I think the number one thing that I always say, like, much less important than who you draft is what your plan is once you draft them.
Because you talk about that a lot with this series, right? But I think it needs to consistently be evaluated, because Frenchie, I just see a lot of these guys that are so good. And I really wonder if the teams that are drafting these players know what the hell to do with them.
And I think, again, you saw that Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah, like, he had his, he's been decent, but he really broke through this past year. And it took a couple of years to get to that point, because you have to figure out how to use someone who's unique. Being unique and different like that, it has a lot of benefits. You stand out, but that doesn't mean everyone's going to know what to do with you. I think especially for someone like Isaiah Simmons, it takes the unique minds to be able to turn them into a little bit more. And he came, Wink Martindale is a unique mind as well. And that's when Simmons started to see a bit more success, but they also made him full-time linebacker. And what he had a lot of success with was blitzing and covering tight ends, the sorts of things he does. I think the biggest point right now is that if you're going to have, if being in coverage is going to be one of your assets, that has to be the primary asset, because you can't be a cover player in this league right now as a secondary thing, because it's too vital. There's too much that goes into it. You have to do too much studying, and to balance all of those things as the second or third thing that you do just doesn't work in today's NFL with the massive priority you have to put on your coverage.
Also talked about the tight end and how vital that position has become, right? Where you're going to see a Brock Bowers probably drafted within the top 10, if not definitely the top 13, 14. And the way the tight end game has changed, like, there you see evident, right, where even an aging Travis Kelce is able to just burn teams in the playoffs, because so many of those linebackers are ill-equipped to handle a player of that caliber, right? And now that the linebacker position has become – or I'm sorry, that the tight end position has become so much more vital, I think tight ends have to do – or I'm sorry, linebackers have to do a much better job of knowing how to kind of cover those tight ends, handle what the tight end does now in today's modern NFL. And if you're seeing a Brock Bowers come out, a linebacker has to be able to cover some of that. If they're not able to, you're kind of looking at a position that's becoming renderless.
Yeah, and a lot of those guys end up becoming players who are used more in blitzing or who get taken off the field and replaced with a safety. And that's the shift that a lot of teams are making, is that it's easier to take a bigger corner or a bigger safety and teach them how to play in the box as well than it is to get a linebacker and teach him how to play in space.
Exactly. Yeah, and to me, that's the biggest thing.
I was going to say, one point about the tight ends, though, is that despite how vital, you know, they are, is that most teams don't have one.
But they're getting there, man. They're starting to get there.
Oh, and that's absolutely true. And teams are putting a higher priority on trying to find one of those guys. But there is still a lot. It's number one, it is a difficult position to transition to the NFL with. It's not one that you typically see a lot of easy transitions. Sam LaPorta, fantastic that year. Kyle Pitts was the first tight end to break 1,000 yards as a rookie. And before that, the record was Evan Engram with like 700 yards. And Evan Engram had a very good year last year with the Jaguars. But after that, we're talking guys like Jake Ferguson, Cole Kmet, who's been pretty good, Hunter Henry.
Dickinson.
Yeah, Noah Fant, Dalton Kincaid last year. And so these are all players that are really important and move the sticks, but it's also important to recognize just how rare and unique some of these guys are, and that's part of why I think Bowers is almost being underrated for only being a tight end. It's like, no, special tight ends are rare. Special tight ends are very hard to find. That is an added benefit, the fact that he has this position that teams really struggle to account for, and especially when we're talking about linebackers who often get placed on tight ends. And when we talk about covering a tight end, it's also important that we discuss how we're doing that. And what it, not all of these guys are going to be built to handle a tight end in man coverage, but can they press a guy, try and get him off his route and hold him through his zone? I think that's a much easier thing for a lot of these guys. Edgerrin Cooper, I think he can do a pretty good job with a lot of the linebackers he'll face in zone. Maybe if he gets his hands on him at, you know, as they're coming off of their route and he's going into his back pedal, like that's the sort of thing that he can do. What I don't think he's capable of doing right now is trying to hang with one of those guys and figure out if it's a slant or a sluggo in man. Like there's the split there. And it's, again, if you're going to be starting one of these rookie linebackers, like you need to be aware of some of those things too, or understand that this is going to be part of the learning experience. You're drafting someone pretty high. And for all we'd like to say about guys have to earn it. You are investing. And you need to get value out of that investment. And the only way that you can do that is by getting these guys on the field, letting them take their lumps, but having them continue to develop and grow.
So with that being said, how do you see 2 through 5 going here in your linebacking crew?
Yeah, so the next couple guys I've got are really athletic, very much downhill players. And the reason Cooper's at the top of this list is because he is easily the best of the next group in coverage. But these guys all have a ton of playmaking ability that I'm obviously going to talk about. But my number two guy is Jeremiah Trotter Jr. He's playing at Clemson, and Jeremiah Trotter is something I'm sure, or someone I'm sure you remember.
Yeah.
Teams love NFL bloodlines. It's the, oh, his dad played in the league, and everyone's just like, character, check. But Trotter also has a ton of downhill burst. And one of the things I really appreciate about his game is how good he is at eluding blocks, especially in the run game. He does a great job of getting to the shoulder he wants of the lineman so that he can try and make a play. when he goes to the edges, he does a really good job setting the edge. And even though he's not often used in coverage, he is athletic enough to chase down running backs and swings, do the little flares, things like that. But typically, if it's passing play, he's usually a pass rusher or a QB spy. And he can get a little bit lost in zone. He's also a bit undersized, around 6 feet, and if he doesn't attack first, he can lose. He's got to win on first hit when he's, you know, meeting alignment. But another thing that teams are going to need to consider is who he's playing with, because he was playing next to Barrett Carter, who did not come out this year and might actually be a better linebacker prospect than Trotter right now. So it's something to consider that that's what he's playing next to. And Carter's able to handle some of the things that Trotter struggled with, to allow Trotter to play more free and the sort of things that he does well. At three, I have Peyton Wilson from North Carolina State. Go Pack. Shout out to my older brother.
Yeah.
And Peyton Wilson is a football player, but he is old with a big injury history. He's 24. Actually, he turned 24 today, so happy birthday to Peyton Wilson.
Happy birthday, brother.
he's got a phenomenal burst downhill. He's another one really good at diagnosing plays, and he shows some pretty good athleticism. He ran 4.43. He had decent vert, his 10-yard splits 1.54, so he does have all that. And all that stuff is great. And he's also doing this at 6'4", 233. So like football player's football player, but also gets a bit lost in zone and might not have the quickness and flexibility for man. So he very much is going to be someone who has to come down and be an edge player and a blitzer when we're talking about what are you doing on third down and what are you offering on passing downs. What he's offering is explosion, strength, and the ability to crash hard. Really athletic player, but his injuries go back to high school. I'll let teams investigate it for themselves. I have him here based strictly on the tape. And for me, he's someone who I think has a role and a lot of really good explosive qualities, but is limited in what you're going to be able to do with him. Junior Colson from Michigan, another one, explosion, really powerful. And for someone who is at Michigan, you know that you're going to be playing against a lot of stars. And one of the things that you can see with his tape, and it was, I've cited this man before, but if it's not my idea, I have to give you a name. And Lance Zierlein pointed out that
again, Lance Zierlein getting the
point. Listen, I'll cite my source, but Zierlein was the first one I heard point out that Colson has more assisted tackles than solo tackles, which I thought was a fascinating thing to track. Now he's 6'2", ton of explosion. And a really sound tackler. Very few missed tackles, which is something that I know, at least for me, is something that I require from my linebackers, because there's nothing worse than watching a linebacker get shed off and seeing a, you know, running back with a head of steam heading towards your 5'10 safety. He has really good quickness in zone, and while he's in zone, he can be an above average player there. However, while his side-to-side quickness shows up, well, his downhill explosion can be slow. And it's slow both coming down to make a play on the ball, but also trying to meet a lineman in the hole. And I think this might have a bit to do with why he's on assisted tackles more than he is solo tackles, because he's getting caught up with linemen. He's a little bit late to the play and the pile's already starting. So especially for someone coming from such a powerhouse organization like Michigan was last year. That's something to really focus on while you're going through this process. What's he going to be around your team with your guys? And when he's not around a team that has an ability advantage, unless he gets drafted to the Ravens, then congratulations. You do it again. This is perfect. And that's honestly possible. Read recently, and this time I don't know who said it, so I apologize. But I read recently that the Ravens have taken a Michigan player in the first round for 3 of the last 4 drafts. Someone's going to have to double check that, but we know the Harbaugh connection is very real between those two. And my number 5 and my last guy here, and this is a very raw player, and he is at the moment all traits, no tools, a huge athletic player. And I'm right out here. He is someone who gets a bit scattered in zones where he's going to a space, not the man in his space. But the athletic traits of Tevin Wallace from Kentucky are unreal. And when he makes the right read, and that's something that is a area that's still developing. He's young. He just turned 21. And he's coming out as a true junior here, which we're seeing less and less of because of the NIL. But he is someone with an outstanding acceleration. When he's able to key in on a linebacker, on a lineman, especially when there's a pulling lineman, he does a great job of meeting that man in the hole and blowing up the plays. And that's something that it just pops on the tape with him. He's got really great hands when the ball is in the air. His sideline to sideline speed is top tier. And even as a pass rusher, you can see a bit of that quick agility, quick change of pace that's going to make it so that ability exists. And it's something teams will have to account for. But his instincts and his ability to read the plays, especially in pass, are very much a work in progress. He's someone who I think is going to have to come in, and he'll be a special team star and someone who's going to come in sub packages and have a real role just based on the traits and tape that he has. But I would struggle putting him in the starting lineup right now. And if you are going to have him in that starting lineup, and he's someone who I've got a high round 4 grade on, so we're talking top of day 3. These aren't guys who are typically going to be starting. So I just want to lay that out. And a lot of the rankings have him lower than I have him there. I'm fine with that. I rank guys where I rank them. But he's not someone you would draft expecting to have that sort of role unless you're taking him much earlier than I'm expecting he would go. But his tape did remind me of a much more raw but similar Jamin Davis, who is also a Kentucky player. And he got drafted in the first round by Washington at the time, and that was higher than I thought he'd go as well. So it might be possible. We've seen how many teams can fall in love with a player and their tools and just go all in for him. And he's someone where the tools really are limitless.
This is why you're the best, because I took PFF's top 10 linebackers. He's nowhere near the group. Like, come on, man. Like, I try to do my research and here you go. Like, well, it's wild. And by the way, that's just a credit to you and all the tape that you watch. And this is why people should listen, because he's nowhere near the group that I was going to consider you evaluating. So, all right.
No, I've watched Cedric Gray and Tommy Eichenberg and all the other guys who might be on their list too.
And you know what's funny, Frenchie, is Eichenberg's a guy that you can recall making plays in big games, right? Like, that's somebody that if you were to put in your French 5, people would be like, oh, okay, I kind of get it. But again, like, you're not playing the hits.
No, and listen, if you want to know what other people's rankings are, you can go hear them. There's plenty of it, but that's bring me on here so that I can give you mine. And
that's not being done in a lot of draft scouting conversations. And I feel like a lot of it's become lazy, where it's, oh, I hear Eichenberg. Remember that play he made against Penn State? Remember that play he made against Michigan? Okay, fine. But Like, that's where we value your opinion so much more, because it goes so much more beyond the tape of a couple of big games where Ohio State rolled, right?
Yeah, and no, then listen, I appreciate your kind words, and I do this for the love of the game, and that's why I very much, I hold my own when I do this. But like someone like Eichenberg, you can talk about all the big moments he had in big games, but we're talking about how players are going to be in the NFL, and I don't mean to attack him immediately. He's just one of the names that came in, but he's someone where you seriously have to question the lateral mobility that he has, the sideline to sideline speed, the quickness that it takes to play his own coverage. I don't know if his athletic traits are going to allow him to handle passing down situations. And I don't know if he has the burst to switch to edge rusher sort of situation. So even though he is a more polished player, and if I was starting one in a defense to, you know, tomorrow, I might pick Eichenberg over Wallace, but as a prospect and as a future NFL player, not just this year, but for a career, that's why I'll give Wallace the boost, because you can take those tools and mold them into something a little bit more than what these other guys are and what the other guys can be. Wallace might not turn into anything, but if you get him in the right situation where he has the chance to learn and star in the roles that he'll be put in, because he's too athletic and too talented to just keep off a football field. He might be more athlete than player, but he's a three-syllable athlete. He's going to develop into something. He has all the tools. It seems like from everything that I've read about, from what coaches have to say about him, is that he is developing and he is willing to learn and putting in that work. So if all of what they're saying is true, and we always have to give that caveat, but that's the sort of thing where you take a hyper athlete, you take someone who, really relishes playing the linebacker position the way you want it to be, in the most athletic and punishing sort of way, allow him to have the time to continue to grow as a player. And I think that a team can genuinely be very rewarded for what he can be.
I agree with you. And again, at this point, right, we're talking about the fifth linebacker out of your French five, out of a position that's probably seeing its best player drafted in the second round.
It genuinely might be the worst position in the class. I think linebacker and safety are fighting for it.
So, exactly, right?
Lots of excitement to come, everybody.
Yeah. But so again, like, we're talking about the fifth prospect being a little bit of a project, right? But it doesn't always mean like, hey, we're going to take this guy who played at a Power 5 conference team and won a lot of games and made a lot of plays and we're immediately going to put him into this, right? You're saying, here's a guy who, if he gets drafted into the right position on the right team, who has the right plan for him and can develop him properly, we're looking at a potential stud. And I think that's what really matters when we're looking at the French five. We're not necessarily looking at guys who, hey, I'm going to take all of these people who are going to be first-round picks or second-round picks. Some of these guys might be a little bit later down the line, but if the right front office has the plan for them, this is a player who we're going to see on Sundays make a real impact. And again, I think that that just really matters when we're talking about who you're evaluating.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate the chance to clarify a couple pieces with it too.
Yeah, and again, like we do this every year, and you're gracious enough to give us your time and your space of evaluating all these players. And I think people get a misconceived idea of, hey, we're looking at players who are going to be first-round picks, or why didn't my team not take this guy and all that? And that's not really what we're trying to do here. We're trying to evaluate the best players from these position groups and see what they could potentially be if they're drafted in the right spot, right?
Yeah, and that's always the goal. Listen, if you're wondering why your team didn't take a guy you wanted, a lot of it can be because they don't work in a system or a scheme that works for them. And teams miss. And, you know, this is the beauty of the draft. One of my favorite things about the draft is that it's the thing that we work towards and put all of our effort to, but it also doesn't have any immediate results. Like the draft, we take the, like a team takes the players, but that doesn't give you a win. You got to still go out, earn it on the field. And for the people who aren't the players, which is, you know, many of us, everybody else has to do their part to make sure that they got people who are going to be successful. And that's part of the fun of the growth and development that happens with all of this. And then always my other favorite part of the draft is that it's the one time of year every team gets better. And aside for a couple teams, I like that.
Yeah, exactly. So with that being said, and I think that we did a nice job of clarifying everything, because, you know, when people listen to this French 5 series, I think they really believe that if we get one of the top five players from each position, we're in great standing, when not taking into account that you're looking at these players, again, as prospects and not necessarily from day one starters who are going to come in and be Pro Bowlers. So
every year, taking a top five quarterback this year is very different from last year. All the positions continue to shift around, but I think we've qualified enough to be able to move on to the next group.
I agree with you. So with that being said, let's go into the corners, because another bespoke position that has a lot of talent on the front end, but also in the back end and probably in the middle round. I'm really fascinated to see how you go with this. And I know you and I have a running joke about maybe somebody who's definitely going to be in your top five. I wonder if he's going to be in your top two or maybe even one. So go ahead.
Yeah, he's not going to be in my top one. Although the great irony is that some other groups do have him, and I thought that I was going to be the highest on him because I got him in my top half of the draft. But this is a fantastic corner class. If you are looking for a cornerback in the first, second, third, fourth, fifth round, whatever it is, like, you can find guys this year, which is pretty fantastic, especially considering that this is going to be one of the weaker back halves of drafts. Just because the NIL, there's going to be a lot of students out there who can keep making more money by staying in college for the first time ever. But, you know, there's still guys in the back of the group like Chav Smith-Wade, Storm Duck out of Louisville, one of the best names in the class.
Phenomenal. What a name.
What a name. And one of the best stories in the draft is a guy by the name of Quantez Stiggers. Also a great name, but a great story. He tried going the college route, didn't work, so he went to the Fan Control Football League for a bit.
Nice.
He switched to CFL last year, and actually he had a pretty good season, and it meant that I had to watch CFL games to get a little bit of information. But he was playing with the Toronto Argonauts, and I still can't get over that that's the name of Toronto's team. But Stiggers has had a lot of contact with teams, and he was able to do that before a lot of these other pieces were happening, because he's a free agent from the CFL, so it's a different process for him. But since this
really is sick, you know, that like when people talk about like, hey, does Frenchie really know what he's talking about? It's like, he's watching CFL games. He's watching the Players League. Like, I guarantee you that a couple of years ago, you had players from the app in here. So,
listen, it's just when I hear about a player and I don't know them, it sticks with me. And I just have to go watch, and I have to go figure out a bit of who they are and read what I can, just watch some. It's just part of the way I'm geared. But let's start at the top of the group instead of focusing on someone who I do hope everybody goes and looks up a bit, in Quantez Stiggers, because even if you don't like his game, his story is fantastic. But at the top of this class, I've got Quinyon Mitchell from Toledo. Now, I don't know the last great cornerback from the MAC, so I'm guessing it might be a little bit, but Toledo, they might have produced a good one here, because Mitchell very much reminds me of like a small school Devin Witherspoon from last year. He is a hyper aggressive, hyper physical corner. He's a phenomenal athlete, 4.33 40. The recovery ability is great, greasy hips, really smooth and violent tendencies. If you're looking for negatives, he's a bit average sized at 6 foot and 190 pounds. Probably could use a little bit more, but with his physicality, but he's someone who's going to go inside and outside. He fits with just about everybody, whatever you're running. I will say he's got a bit of dick fingers, even though he has really great ball production in the breakups. So he came out of college.
Where are the dick fingers, Frenchie?
Yeah, you got. I don't want to be, you know, too rude to the guy, but you got some dick fingers there. For those who don't know, Sean and I, it goes back. We didn't have, you know, dicks and fingers, but don't judge me. So Mitchell had 6 career interceptions, which sounds fine, but it's worth keeping in mind that 4 of those happened in one game. He's got a few dropped ones otherwise along the way, but in terms of pass breakups, he's still got a ton of ball production. The skills are there. So he's my number one guy. Number 2 and 3, I've got the Alabama guys back to back. Tarrion Arnold just ahead of Kool-Aid. And the reason for that is that he's got a little bit more agility, and that sort of agility I think is going to serve him well. And Arnold is very physical and tackles really well too. He can be over aggressive, which I think is not the worst problem to have if you're comparing them. Kool-Aid, on the other hand, my number 3, he's got great eyes and his feel for the position is exceptional. Really physical in the routes and fantastic at the line of scrimmage. He's someone who I think is going to have some times where he gets beat. His recovery is only okay. He's got average agility. He ran a 4.5 something, and that's kind of how the tape looked as well. He's really an outside-only player, but this is something not to overthink. He's a fantastic technician, really physical, and someone who I think is really going to be at his best in the red zone. So when you get to the money spot on the field, like, this is where you really need to shut somebody down. When the field shrinks a little bit, that's when McKinstry is going to get better. At my number 4.
Can I ask you a question on Kool-Aid?
Yeah.
Before you keep going? Okay. Lot better year in 2022 than he had in 2023. Mm-hmm. Couple questions about his wherewithal, a little bit of question on, you know, how bad did he want it. I think last year there was a lot of talk about him being a definite first-round pick. He came back, and this year, hey, maybe first round is the ceiling, probably more there in round 2. What did you see watching the tape that indicated, if at all, and again, I'm going off narrative, I'm not going off of my own personal opinion. What did you see from Kool-Aid this past year that maybe wasn't ringing true in year 2 in 2022? Is that overblown? I'm rambling. What are your thoughts?
I think a bit of it gets overblown. His game reads as someone who is very well prepared. You don't have the route anticipation that McKinstry has without having prepped heavily going into the game. I think that there are some effort inconsistencies, but it's the majority of it is after the pass is thrown and not in his direction. So what you do see from him sometimes is, let's say, he's playing on the corner and there's a crossing route and he just kind of like lets up on the play. His receiver then goes off, blocks somebody else, and it breaks 3 because his effort wasn't as strong. So I think those are the things that came out a little bit more. The other thing I'll say is that a lot of his drop, and drop being in terms of like where mock drafts start putting him, comes after the combine. And at the combine, he was mediocre. Additionally, he also had a foot injury, so his pro day numbers were better. And then 2 days after the pro day, he went and had surgery on his foot. So I think that that's a little more difficult to figure out how some of those pieces might have been in play with those numbers, or how the injury is being perceived by teams. But I think that he's someone who the tape has shown that he is a player with enough athleticism, a lot of talent, who's well prepared and plays with a ton of anticipation, and when the ball's in the air, your receiver is going to have very little room for error if you're going up against Kool-Aid, because he's a technician. And it's one I think that teams are overthinking. This is, for me, one of the things that I believe, and one day I'm going to spend a couple days or months sitting down and trying to figure out, by going through endless draft classes, if we've gotten worse at drafting the further out the draft goes. Because I think this is a classic paralysis by analysis, where guys who are at the top for too long, we have to try and find reasons to pull them down.
See, you are preaching to the choir. You and I have texted about this well off the pod several months ago. The process is too long. And I really do believe that we're looking at players. And I think by the time that March rolls around and the combine is done, first of all, there has never been a bad pro day. Pro days are meant for these guys to succeed, right? So, like, at my point of view is, and I'm not watching the tape as much as you, I'm not evaluating guys as hard as you are, but I'm simply looking at it like, we have years of game tape to watch a lot of these players at what they do against different teams and different systems. And I just think that this is the point where we're trying too hard, and the GMs and front offices and coaching staffs that are really looking at like combines and pro days as they're going to sway their entire view of players. Like, I think you're fucked. I think you're doing way too much, and you're going to probably mess up. Pro days and the combine is what got Zach Wilson picked number 2 overall. Like, this is not the time that we're supposed to start reconfiguring all of our thoughts about players that we watch for 2-3 years, sometimes 4. Like, come on, man. I'm sorry to go off on that rant, but you kind of triggered me here. Like, I look at Kool-Aid, I'm like, he was one of the best cornerbacks. He was one of the best playmakers in the SEC. Why are we thinking this hard about him? But when I asked my question to you, it was the big narrative of him is that year 3 was a lot worse than year 2. And how much are teams going to look at that?
Yeah, and it's going to be on them. And this is where I think the big point of the interview needs to kind of get a bit of a focus, because the teams will get the chance to talk to him and let Kool-Aid answer for himself. And it's on them to figure out, you know, what they believe, what they take away, and who they think that he'll be for them. The mental aspect of all of this is critical. And you get the opportunity to ask those questions, or they do at least. So ask them, find out. This is the luck that teams have that I don't, is that they get to spend what feels like an eternity doing Zoom interviews at this point. Because they're still doing them. I think until Wednesday, they're allowed to continue doing Zoom interviews.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and at a certain point, you got to just kind of pause and ask, what are we still doing here? But it makes too much money for the NFL not to keep pushing the draft off and showing every pro day on, you know, ESPN and all the rest of it. So as long as the money keeps being right, they're going to keep doing this.
Any other job, it's like, if we can't decide whether you're a good candidate for the role within four weeks, four months, like, honestly, like, what, A, who is hiring me, and B, like, what kind of candidate am I actually looking at if I'm still evaluating them after 4 months? Like, I don't know, man. The process is too long. It allows too much room for error. It allows teams to, I mean, hey, the one thing I will say is you definitely get your clarity on the smart teams and dumb teams, because the dumb teams that are like, you know what, we're going to wash away all this game tape and only look at early March through, you know, late April. Hey, all right, like, we're going to take that into consideration. Great. But I still think it's like, if we had this in late March, it would be much easier to decipher who are the great prospects and who aren't.
Yeah, and part of my issue with it all, too, is especially for things like combine and pro day numbers, more importantly than all of that, like, the players all have GPSs on them. The teams are getting all the speed and impact and all of the statistics like that from what's happening in the game. The underwear Olympics numbers ought to mean less to them, and they might. But again, the combine has become such a, you know, financial boon for the league that it's never going away, and this process is going to continue. And maybe it's not for the best of teams. Hopefully some good ones will poach other good executives away and implement better strategies. But you know, until then, they're working with what they got.
Before we keep going, I'm just going to put a bow on this because this is your podcast and I'm not supposed to be giving as many opinions as I am, but it just triggered me. And like, you know, I hope that eventually, listen, for whatever financial benefit it gives to the league, great. But if teams and front offices are truly making their evaluations after all this time, I mean, I value the Senior Bowl a lot. I know you do too. I value obviously what's done in regular season and postseason play for 2-3 years, sometimes 4 for these prospects. Like I just don't think that this should be the reason you're picking players. But again, I just have never loved the combine. I've never loved the entire thought process of saying, hey, because he ran this 40 or jump this vert, like this is why this player is shooting up draft boards.
How many times have we watched the Raiders take, you know, the guy who ran the fastest? And
all the time, right? Like Darius Hayward Bay, number one, right? It's like he ran the fastest time at that point in the combine. Anyway, so all right, we got the one rattle off the rest of your corners for us, 4 and 5.
Yeah, but I look forward to the email saying, but he liked Xavier Worthy. So number 4.
We're getting him.
Number 4 is where my guy is, Cooper DeJean from Iowa. He is being typecasted as a safety, and I will not stand for it because he's a fantastic corner. His tape is outstandingly boring because teams don't want to test him. And speaking of don't test, he also had an injury, so he couldn't test at the pro day, at the combine. He did stuff at the pro day. He tested really well. More importantly, he was healthy enough to do some of the stuff. So for me, that's good enough. That's all I got. But more importantly, his ability, his eyes, especially in zone, are fantastic. His movement ability is strong. Both his recovery and deep speed are excellent. He mostly played in the typical zone shells that Iowa uses. But when he's able to be at the line of scrimmage, he was really successful, especially in press man. His ball skills are fantastic. And he does a really good job of playing with his back to the ball. So, you know, if someone throws a fade within 10, 15 yards and he's not able to turn around well, he does a really good job of getting his arms up without attacking the wide receiver and getting flags thrown. If there is something worth clearing up with him, it's his hips. They're not they're a little squeaky. And he's better with tackling receivers than he is in the run game. He's not overly physical, but his athleticism, I think, is pretty much on display all the time. I know this is something that you despise with great players, but he was the Big Ten returner of the year, return specialist of the year. I'll tell you, Kool-Aid McKinstry, pretty decent punt returner, too.
I don't mind it.
But DeJean also, you say that till Adoree Jackson plays punt returner, and then all of a sudden
I don't mind it coming out, just I hope you know their asset is about to be damaged good. So
I didn't mean to trigger you again, but and DeJean did also, the injury that he suffered made it so he couldn't test at the combine, he got while practicing as a wide receiver there. But with the Gene, there's definitely some boring tape out there. But the best boring tape is his 2022 tape against Ohio State, where while covering Marvin Harrison Jr. and Jackson Smith and Jigba, he allowed zero catches. So when you give him the opportunity to go against some of the guys at the top, he does a damn good job of it. The other guys ahead of him have a little bit more ability to play both man and zone, or at least the experience to do it. Though I think DeJean has the capability of it. He doesn't have the sort of quickness that I think would make him able to go inside outside like some of the other guys, which is just, these are the little pieces that I'm slicing through when I'm trying to put this list here, because literally my grades on these guys are all middle of round one, except for Quinion Mitchell, who is right on the fringe of the top 10. Arnold McKinstry and DeJean are all within a couple picks of each other, and they're all middle of round two. And then right at the back end of my middle to late round two is Nate Wiggins out of Clemson. If you want someone who is, I don't know, if you want just pure explosion, like, this man is C4. He is a springy and explosive athlete. His agility is top of the class. His movement, especially in man, is second to none. The problem is he's skinny, and he plays like it. He's 165 pounds, and he plays like he's about a buck 45. His tackling ability, I think, makes it so he can only play on the outside. You can't put him in the slot because they will just run right at him and he'll get wiped. As much as I loved Emmanuel Forbes last year, I can't get out of my head how frail he looked and how that, you know, affected him. So maybe I have a bit layover from that. But again, I still have him right around the 20 mark. And I think Wiggins has the all of the athletic gifts that you could ever want, in addition to the fact that he is pretty sticky in coverage as well. In zone, his eyes can get a little bit lost trying to switch from receiver to ball. But aside from that, like, he's someone who just needs, you know, a couple roast beef sandwiches and a tackling dummy, and he'll be able to be a pretty damn good corner for you. And this is just the top five here. We have a lot of guys left, but I do want to just highlight Mike Sanristil from Michigan, because he is a pure slot corner, also 5'10", but he's a lot bigger than Nate Wiggins for two guys who are supposedly undersized together. And Sanristil is a elite competitor, high level of compete, and a really good tackler as well. And he's someone who has elite quickness. He played in the slot for Michigan. He should walk into the league and be able to be a slot starter right away. You just have to see him at, you know, 5'10", 180, 190, somewhere in there that he is. He has the tackling technique, and he has all the heart and, you know, let's go as far as anger in the world for it. You just have to figure out if that body's going to hold up.
That's kind of the thing when I'm looking at corners right now, is you got to have the size. You got to have the physicality, man, right? Like, I think Forbes, from a technician standpoint, is right there. But he just struggled to body guys.
Yeah.
And I think that was a huge issue for him. Whereas you look at Deontay Banks for the Giants, like, he might be lacking a little bit in the technician standpoint. You kind of wish he had a little bit more Forbes in him, but he made the tackles. He won a lot of one-on-one matchups, even as a pretty raw rookie corner, because he has the size, right?
And you could go another step with Joey Porter Jr., who pulled the second round for the Steelers. That's another one where he had all the physical tools in the world coming out, but he matches that size with a lot of the other, you know, techniques, which is part of why I had them where I did. But yeah, so it'll be fascinating for me to watch how Forbes continues to develop, because as I, you know, take time reflecting on my, you know, rankings and stuff from a few years back, I you can't do it right after the rookie year, because how many guys have we seen blow up in year two and three? But if you're looking for size in a corner, TJ Tampa is probably the way to go out of Iowa State. He's someone who tested well, and he's hyper-physical. He's in that 6'1", 6'2", sort of area, depending on whose number you look at. And he's also got pretty long arms. And he can get a little bit juked out when he's in space. But he is phenomenal in run sport and really likes to use his size and his strength to his advantage, too.
Go to the safeties, bro.
Oh, do we have to? I really tried to find...
It's not the most fun position grouping, but we have to do it.
Hey, I love the safety position when they're good, but I tried real hard. I thought I was going to have... When I was just kind of, you know, coming up with these thoughts in my head, I thought for a while and said, I wonder if there's going to be 10 corners before I have one safety. There wasn't, but it came all right close. My top guy here, who I've got a second round grade on, is Tyler Newbin from Minnesota. 6'2", 205, really high IQ, played all over the field, strong vision, and that's really what gets him where he needs to be. It's the sort of thing where he just kind of knows where the play's headed, which is great. But he's someone who you're going to have to look at playing in a too high or in a low zone because the deep speed's just not there. So if you're going to leave him on an island on the back, you're playing with fire a little bit. The safety position as a whole, a lot of them tested pretty poorly, and that's going to hurt them come draft day. So it'll be fascinating to see where him and my number three guy go. But my number two before that is Javon Bullard, a Bulldog. And he's the pure Swiss Army knife type versatility, but it really comes out when you look at where he played his snaps. In 2022, he didn't have anything over 100 snaps except for the slot. And then this past year, he didn't have anything over 100 snaps except for playing the deep spot. And so you really see all the kind of versatility he has. And he was both great in both years. He's really tight in the a little bit tight in the hips, but he's really physical too. Very quick, fearless player, little undersized, but all last year he only missed 7 tackles. And as a slot player the year before, only missed 5. So... again, he's the sort of player that teams are going to have to figure out where exactly that they want to pull him, but he's done everything pretty damn well, and I think is going to be a good player and is definitely going to be in competition to be the first one to come out. I've got him and Newbin pretty much right there with each other, but I do prefer what Newbin's able to bring just with his size and his IQ, you know, back when he's able to have a little bit of time in the back pedal there. But, you know, it's not to say there's anything with Bullard. It's just one of those things that, you know, when you're going back and forth, his tight hips, I think, might hinder him a little bit more than Newbin's lack of deep speed. So, again, we're splitting hairs here. I have the same grade on the two of them, but I just put Newbin ahead of him because of those pieces. But my number three, who I have a late round two on, is a guy who, when I was writing my notes, I have it on my sheet here. That I thought he was hung over at the combine because
that's not a great note, but
it's almost one of those things where it's like a stupid penalty. Like, this is the whole thing that you were training for. And how did it go like this? He tested, I think, in like the bottom 30% or something. If you look at the relative athletic score over the last like decade or so for guys to come out at the safety position. He ran a 4.65 in the 40.
Is this, by the way?
Pardon?
Who is this?
Oh, I'm sorry. Cameron Kitchens.
There you go. All right.
Thanks. So his testing, I think, really dropped him for a lot of people. And for me, you see that lack of speed. He's someone who I think is going to be a lot better cover three, cover four, than he would be as man single high or, put on an island in man or anything like that. But he's someone who I think is going to be really good in that sort of big nickel, maybe in that money backer sort of role. The other guy that he played next to, though, was James Williams, who's, again, a 6'5 safety who was definitely going to transition to that role. So he didn't have the opportunity to do that. He played a lot of, time as the pure deep safety. And you could see that he's back a little bit further than most, but he's smart enough to be able to do that, which I appreciate. He had fantastic production in college. his tape is really good. You see him making high IQ plays over and over where you're just thinking, how was he there? And then when you watch the tape back, you can see him turning to go towards the receiver that the ball's headed to as the quarterback starts to go into his motion. So his reaction time, his mental reaction, very, very quick. He's really tough. He's an absolute thumper, and I love him for it. But the other thing that you have to keep an eye on with him is you can see a lot of plays where they're yelling at each other in the secondary about coverage lapses. And if you're going to be the safety and back there, part of that is you're the communicator. So it's something that I think teams are going to have to keep an eye on. One note that came with him is that on two different touchdowns versus North Carolina, he was going back and forth about coverages with another player. Now, whose fault that is, I'm not sure. That's something that you got to ask him in an interview, and I haven't gotten the chance to yet.
By the way, in that interview, if he says it's coaching, do you look at that as a negative thing, or do you look at that as a, hey, listen, I'm just being honest with you, and I can diagnose the play right now? Or do you look at that and potentially say, hey, that was on me, and I need to do a better job?
My questions mostly are, when you and the slot corner are going back and forth about this, what are you arguing about? What did you
The North Carolina whole thing was kind of weird this year anyway. So.
Yeah, I mean, they were an up and down team. And again, that is a rough game. And Kitchens had a lot of other good ones. Go watch him against Florida State and you see some pretty nice plays.
I was gonna say, he had a couple games where, to me, he was the focal point and the most positive thing that any Miami situation was this year.
Yeah, listen, he's someone that I will still pound the table on because I think his tape is that good. But the athletic questions that we had were made bigger questions. And these are just things that teams get to ask that we don't. So they get to be so for me, they have to be a little bit more of a question mark. I don't get to say, this is what he said. I explained it. I can take that off of my questions or my negatives for him.
As an evaluator, are you happy that you don't have to be in that situation where you have to ask the players the questions, or you're in the room when the players are actually answering those questions? Or do you like to be more in this objective spot that you're in, evaluating players surely based off of tape and based off of second and third hand analyses that you're reading, hearing, and listening to?
Well, I'd love to see how the other side looks sometime, but I do think that if I had my druthers, if I was building out, this is crazy talk, but if I was building out my organization, I would have some of my scouts very specifically. I would have just pure film scouts. I would have a group of guys. Like, I still want all the road scouts like they got and the whole process, but I would have a separate group of guys who are just there watching film, because at the end of the day, that's what we are talking about, is what shows up on game day. And Kitchens, he shows up on game day. Like, it was not an easy choice to put these guys where I had them, because Newbin and Bullard, I think, are also going to be players and probably starters at two different positions potentially of safety. But for me, Kitchens is going to be right up there with it. I think that his testing showed that there might be some lapses that you have to figure out, but to run as slow as he did and still be as successful as he was as a center fielder, there's something to be with that. What I'd really love to know is what the numbers look like for his GPS times. How does that translate? Because I think that, considering it's on the field, would give you a lot better of a understanding of how these guys happens. And I was talking negatively about that Carolina game, but if you watch that Carolina game, he has an absolutely gorgeous quick trigger QB, like read his soul sort of interception against Drake May. And if you go watch him, in other games, Florida State, Clemson, you see him just out physicaling people. Not a word, but I'm making it one. And who he is on the tape just shines. And He doesn't have the athletic traits that give him a first round grade for me, but the film has to be good enough. And it really is. I think he's someone who, because that may not be a, you know, perennial all-star, you know, that sort of thing. He's also not going to be someone you can routinely drop down and have play man in the slot. He's going to be a little bit more, you know, tight cast into the split safety, cover forward, you know, deep middle on his own, use your instincts sort of thing. So again, it's not so much that like, his 40 time was horrible, so I got to drop him. It's that his lack of speed also shows up on the field, and it's going to limit the amount of roles that he can have. But the roles that he will have are going to be solid, and just like Penn State edge rushers, there are certain positions, running backs from LSU, and you take Miami safeties. Just do it.
And you got Ed Reed as a prototype. Like, I was going to say, to use your term, paralysis by analysis, right? I feel like this guy could be a victim of that, where if you watch his game tape, you're going to say, I'm very happy making my selection with him because he shows out. And as we talked about the Carolina game, Carolina is kind of a weird team. But if he can make that kind of impact, you feel pretty damn good about it, and you forgive the mistakes. If you overanalyze him, you might pass on him, and then you watch a team, potentially in your own division or in your own conference, take him and be like, well, God damn it, he was right there, and we just overthought it.
Yeah, I'm all hyped on Cam Kitchens again, and now after we record this pod, I'm going to go pass out, and before bed, I'm going to throw on a little Cam Kitchens. I tell you, like, he's not at the top of my list. I've been through it, but he probably has the most fun film to watch at this position. And I think there's going to be a team that picks him up later than I've got him graded, because those numbers are going to scare teams off. And there's going to be a fan base who goes after the draft, learns about this kid, watches him, and they're going to be real happy with the player they got.
And after week 3 or 4, it's like NFL Red Zone, Scott Hansen has Cam Kitchens making another interception, and you're like, God, Jesus Christ. Here we go. And again, that's my favorite part of the French Five, is this is strictly analysis. This is strictly evaluation. This is not like projecting, hey, immediately from day one, you should be so happy you got this guy. It's like, no, here's what he's projecting as a prospect. And I think that's what's most fun, because you know what, man? I'm just going to be honest with you. There's a lot of podcasts where I think people are just going to be like, he's going to be this, or he's going to do that, and we're projecting him to do this. And you're just coming out here being like, here's what the tape shows, man, and we'll see what happens.
Yep. And this is why The Ringer has one of my favorite phrases. And it's when they do their comps, they say shades of. And that's kind of when I'm talking about my comps. Like, the way that I'm looking at these is like, if when things go right, if when everything clicks and when this player's at his best, who does it remind you of? What's this like? And if they can have some similar flaws too, that just kind of brings it together. But all these guys are going to be their own. Especially
right. Shout out to Shilpadia and Ben Solak on The Ringer. They do a great job.
And this actually goes nicely into my number 4 guy, who I have a high third round grade on, and that's Jaden Hicks out of Washington State. Again, this is a player who's very much going to be role dependent. He is the bigger safety who mostly plays down low. Hook, curl, flat, press, cover the tight end, running backs at the side. Maybe slot, but again, probably in the zone slot. Not going to be single high. You could probably two high him, but maybe not regularly. Don't two high him like Patrick Graham. Like, two high him occasionally. Anyway, but Hicks is heavy hitting. He is 6'2", 205, and he blasts guys, and I love it. He has really good downfield momentum. His trigger is real fast. Even if his deep speed and agility isn't elite, his trigger is so quick that he's able to make plays that he otherwise wouldn't be able to if it was just dependent on the quick switch. Last 2 years, just to talk about how diverse his skill set is, even within this kind of role, 155 tackles, 8 tackles for loss, 3.5 sacks, 3 interceptions, and 10 pass breakups. And that's someone who isn't going to be your deep middle of the field safety, who's going to have a lot more traffic to work through, who still has the ability to work through it and get into those spaces there. On the flip side, we have Cole Bishop from Utah at my number 5. And he is someone who measurables is a little bit, less impressive than Hicks. He's got short arms. He has a short wingspan. And that shows up when he's tackling, because when he tackles, he wins with technique. He doesn't win with power or overwhelming, anger or anything. He wins with technique. He's someone who I think is really going to be great in that sort of deep middle zone. But he's someone who I think also has the ability to go play slot. He makes a lot of those sort of high IQ plays. He has some shades of Cam Kitchens, if you want to go with that. But Bishop, he also had that explosive downhill testing that really showed up well. And you see it on the film. And him and Hicks have that similar. And my number 6 guy, Malik Mustafa from Wake Forest. Spectacular name.
Love that name.
And Mustafa's undersized, 5'10", but 209 and stocky and built, and is overwhelmingly physical, like can't be missed sort of physicality. And he's going to go later than where I have him in the late third for my grades, but he's going to be a special team stud. And what I love most about him is the downhill, the trigger, the explosion in those pieces, because that's those split seconds that really make or break plays. That's the split second that turns a slant from a tackle to a touchdown, being able to react quick enough and explode from that reaction, letting it go from your head to your feet, making sure your whole body is in motion with it so that you can go up and make a play. And so my 4, 5, 6 guys, they're all top tier with that, and especially from the safety position where you're coming from so many different angles and positions on the field, you're tackling at all sorts of weird angles again. So having the quick trigger really allows you to simplify that process and make it so that you have a cleaner tackle, you have you give the receiver less of a chance to make a play with the ball. And that all of those little steps, those little micro pieces, make the game a lot easier for you as a safety.
Speaking of special teams, because you went into that right there, I think that segues us perfectly into your last position. And by the way, I just want to say, I don't know if there's any other podcast that give you special teams top 5 players. So again, Ringer, anybody, listen to my French here. We're going to plug you as much as we possibly can. We've been doing the best we can. But before tomorrow, when Will and Tom grace us with their presence and you give us our mocks and the full first round mock, let's finish up with special teams tonight, man.
Yeah, because one of these guys you might be interested to know just had an on-campus visit from the special team coach of the New York Giants. So we'll get to that. But my number one guy from this group, Will Reichard, Alabama. Number one, my number one punter.
Scoring record of Alabama, right?
Scoring record for the NCAA.
There we go.
84 field goals, 295 PATs. And his leg strength is still can use some improvement, but automatic within 40 or 45 yards. After that, as far as kickers go, my next guy who I really like is Harrison Mevis out of Missouri. And who doesn't love a stocky and well-built punter? 6'2", 41. Now that's a man who's going to make some tackles. And
a stocky and well-built punter.
So he has a really powerful leg. He has 12 field goals made from over 50 yards. including a 61-yard game winner to beat Kansas State. But he was less accurate last year than he was the first 2 years, so something to consider. And then the last punter that, or excuse me, the last kicker I want to bring up is Cam Little, who, again, he hit every tee, and we know that that's coming even more important in the NFL now. So if you can be routine at those, a missed PAT is just gut-wrenching for your team. And there's not all that many for each team every year, but God, do they hurt when they hurt. And Josh McCarty's another one out of Stanford who's could get drafted in that same sort of boat.
Early, do you see one of these guys going, right? I mean, naturally.
Kicks out of the league.
New England took their kicker in the fourth round last year. How early do you see one of these guys going?
I mean, maybe fourth or fifth. Probably to a team like Washington or somebody who has a lot of picks and they're willing to like take a chance on a guy that they might have to practice squad afterwards. That's fine. But another kicker who's got an interesting story is Spencer Schrader. He was at Notre Dame, but he was a pro soccer player in Brazil before this. And he only played one season at Notre Dame, but he had 4 field goals over 50 yards. So another leg to keep an eye on. And then for my punters, Torrey Taylor, he is going to be pushing Reichard for the first of these guys to get drafted. And there's he was nicknamed Field Flipper, and he had 43 career games of 40 yards per punt. Which no one else, that's the record. Not that anyone else cares about punting records, but this is why you bring me on. His average punt was 46 yards, which is above average in the NFL. And a lot of power too, but he also has some pretty good hang time. I don't have too many of these guys on my list, but more than most. Austin McNamara out of Texas Tech, 6'4". And there's a lot of long, lanky punters, but he's another one, averaged almost 46 yards punt, and he had 5 seasons as a punter, and he never averaged less than 44 yards. So that's a really nice tool to be able to trust, and also was the holder, which is not always the case in college, where you have so many players. And on college roster, you got like 90 guys, and you know. So you can have a random, wide receiver or QB4 holding in the NFL because of how condensed rosters are with 53 guys and you're only dressing 46, which I think is personally, I can't stand it. I think it's absurd and we really need rosters to expand, which would allow for players to have more time to develop, and it would allow for teams to have more assurances for injuries. All this, especially on offensive line, where you're only, dressing 8 guys, but teams need to keep drafting them because we never have good ones. Anyway,
over
that rant aside, these are the sorts of things that can make a big difference. The great Pat McAfee had a story where he lied when Indianapolis asked him if he knew how to hold, and he was like, yeah, of course, because it's an interview, you always say yes in the interview. And then Adam Vinatieri calls, because guess who you have to hold for, true goat, and he's like, I don't know how to hold. And Vinatieri flew him out to, I think it was South Dakota or something, to just hold kicks for him for a week and go to special holder camp and a bunch of shit. Yeah, because this is the sort of stuff you got to be athletic enough to do. So, when you have guys like him who have, that experience, or people who have a history of playing a lot of other sports and things like that growing up, those things can make a bit of difference. Another player who has some versatility is Jake Browning from San Diego State. Tiny, tiny guy. Well, maybe not tiny, but, for football, tiny, which is how you kind of like your kickers, right? It was the punter, the kicker, and did kickoffs for the last 2 years. He's the only player last year who was on the lists for Best Kicker, Lou Groza Award, and the Ray Guy Award, which is pretty impressive. So that versatility, I think, is going to at least get him on a practice squad. Because if you only have, you know, one extra special teamer on a practice squad, the fact that he can do both, if he's not able to, you know, take a lead role, which is really tough for rookie kickers. You know, guys like Will Reichard and so many of them, McNair is at Texas Tech, and Little is from Arkansas. And a lot of these guys, they're warm weather players. They might have never kicked in the rain or the snow. You know, it's just a whole different world once you get to the NFL. If you're playing at Alabama and Vanderbilt and Arkansas, like, you've never had to kick in Chicago or New York or Foxborough in the snow. You've never planted a foot in snow to kick. And that is a massive thing to adjust to. So for me, the other effects of this make me lean a little bit more towards cold weather guys coming out, at least. But it's something that guys, once they get to the league, even if it's starting with the practice squad and the rest of it, like, this is something you have to learn and develop. And with the draft being in April and the season starting in September, you don't get the time to learn how to kick in the snow over the summer. But the last guy I'll bring up, because I recently read, I think it was the great Art Stapleton, who mentioned that Michael Gobriel, the new special teams coordinator for the Giants, was visiting this guy, Jake Walraith. He only had 1 year at CMU, and before that, he was down at Texas at Tarleton State, which I didn't know was a school. So that was neat. I've been watching two Yankee brothers. That's the Janke brothers.
Where are you going with this?
No, I've been watching two of these brothers out of South Dakota State. Yeah, I was watching the Toronto Argonauts, and yet not once have I watched any film from Tarleton State. But Walraith, he played last year at Central Michigan, so he got a little bit of cold weather fun. And, you know, nice leg, pretty good. A lot of pins, which you love to see, especially at a college punters who are used to just booming, booming, booming. Averaged over 43 yards per punt in cold weather state where he's doing it. So just another guy with a really good leg and some decent aim to it as well. So there's some special teams specialists to keep an eye on. If you're looking for some kick returners, you know, we got athletes all over the place. And the change in kickoffs, I think, is really going to be fascinating to see how it affects some of these guys. Because switching to the XFL kickoffs to make kickoffs a thing again, wouldn't that be nice?
Ray, I really like that. I think that's an awesome adjustment. And also, too. Happy retirement to Matthew Slater, one of the best teamers of all time.
So, not enough love goes into the dirty work on special teams. You know, for all the talk of his
11-year pro, 10-year pro.
I mean, at least he and how many Pro Bowls and the rest of it. I know he's got more than some guys in the Hall of Fame, but shout out Matt Slater. That's the sort of work that goes unnoticed too often. But especially for a lot of these guys in the draft, it's where you're going to have to cut your teeth first. You know, Shannon Sharp always tells the story. I think it was his rookie year he led the team in special team tackles. Because that's the sort of thing that you do. Even if you're a burgeoning star or a young, hot athlete and stuff, if you're not in round one, round two, like, you're going to have to play some of these spots. And it's something that teams are really going to look at for the back of this draft, especially given the NIL bringing a lot of guys who otherwise would have been draftable back to college because they're already making money. So guys aren't rushing to leave school to go get a check. You know, this has led to a lot of guys staying back for another year. And it means that at the back of the draft, we're going to see teams that are either, you know, shooting their shot for stud athletes who might not be able to, you know, have a quick role, or they're going for guys who are going to be able to fill that role as core four, who's going to be able to fill the back spot of that roster, guys who are going to have to play on special teams. So those are the sorts of, you know, athletic traits that you got to see if they transfer, especially if you're talking about guys who haven't been playing special teams because they've been stars in college. But now they're going to be a fourth, fifth round player. And if you're not able to, you know, hold your own as an anti-gunner, like you might not be getting that fourth, fifth cornerback slot in the roster because they need someone who is going to be able to do that.
No, exactly. And I think the special teams is the position that people often overlook, and I will put myself in that category where I kind of dismiss it. But overall, it's something that really matters, and it really shows up in, on Sundays when you're watching your team play. And on those select plays, you see the teams that succeed in it usually have great field position and are able to be opportunistic with that position. And the teams that aren't as good, and you wonder why, and you know, you look back and say, I wish I put more attention into who was playing those positions. So,
yeah, for all we want to say about football being a game of inches, people kind of shrug when we're talking about the punter and when his accuracy is the difference between the ball on the 2 and the ball on the 20.
I'll bring it up because you wanted to say DeSean Jackson's name the other day when we were talking about receiver. Matt Dodge, fuck you and for always. And thank you. So, with that, Frenchie, the French 5 series is done. Dude, this was absolutely phenomenal work. And we're going to come back tomorrow because Tom and Will are going to join us. And we got the Giants mock. We got the Jets mock. We got the Cowboys mock. And we got your full first round plus teams that don't have first round picks mock. So your work is almost done. And then, obviously, the real fun comes after the draft when – you get to see what you did wrong, what you said was right. And I got to be honest, that's some of my most fun podcasting because you've been so right so many times. And even when you're wrong, you're right. So that's going to be a lot of fun too.
Yeah, that's the best part about being wrong. If you do it enough times, you'll have to get something right.
Exactly. So everybody, we'll be talking to you again tomorrow. Frenchie's not quite done, but the draft is 4 days away. It's quite amazing, and we'll be right here for it with all the breaking news and all the action. So, Frenchie, don't sleep too long, bro, because you're coming right back.
Cannot wait, my friend.
All right, guys, take care, and we'll be back tomorrow.